Hello and welcome back to Heights Libraries Podcast, Unpacking 1619, where you can explore the interviews we've collected with scholars from around the country, in which we unpack topics relating to race in America. I'm your host, John Pichet, and I'm thrilled to share these interviews with you here. This week on Unpacking 1619, Professor Emeritus of History at Columbia University, Eric Foner, discusses his book, The Second Founding, How the Civil War and Reconstruction Remade the Constitution. By looking at the history of the debates around each post-war amendment, Professor Foner examines how each amendment sought to permanently end slavery and reconstitute the nation. Here's our full conversation back in April 2022.
I'm Eric Foner. I'm a retired professor from the history department at Columbia University, where I taught for many, many years. And I'm trying to be retired, but failing abysmally. But I'm happy to do events like this for those interested in history.
Absolutely. Yes, it's hard to stay retired, I think. So we're going to discuss your the book you wrote recently called The Second Founding, How the Civil War and Reconstruction Remade the Constitution. Yeah, so if you could give us an overview of the book and kind of what you hope to accomplish by writing it.
Okay. Well, in a certain sense, what I hope to accomplish is embedded in the title of the book, The Second Founding. I want people, both scholars and ordinary people interested in history, to understand that the Civil War and Reconstruction produced a new constitution, a different constitution than what had existed before. These three amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th, were not just changes, minor changes in an existing structure. As I said, they created a new constitution. That's why I say second founding. We know about the founders. We hear about them in the aftermath of the American Revolution. Many of them are very well known. Madison, the father of the Constitution, Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, you name it. But the people who wrote the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments are not exactly household names. How many people have heard of John Bingham? Maybe in Ohio a few more than elsewhere, but still not a household name. What about Henry Wilson? What about quite a few of the other important members of Congress? So I want people to really understand that when we talk about the Constitution, we are living today under the Constitution as rewritten after the Civil War. Sadly, even members of the Supreme Court don't seem to realize that very often. Very often, particularly more conservative members, when they want to talk, for example, the federal system, the balance between the states and the federal government in terms of powers, they go right back to 1787. They jump right back over these amendments as if they were enacted, but they are there. If you look at your Constitution, they're still there, and they shouldn't be ignored the way the Supreme Court, unfortunately, frequently does.
Well, I think that's a good point, because one of the things that you mentioned in your book is kind of how Congress was empowered after the Civil War. So in rewriting the Constitution, I guess, my question is, what was rewritten and how?
Okay, well, the first point is that the original Constitution obviously contained protections for slavery. The word slavery was not included in the original Constitution. They used circumlocutions like persons held to labor, other persons. But when you have the Fugitive Slave Clause, the Three-Fifths Clause, giving the South extra members of Congress and electoral votes, counting the slave population or a part of it, the provision enabling the federal government to help put down insurrections, not to mention slavery, but we know what they're talking about. And, it was a pro-slavery constitution. Now, the 13th Amendment irrevocably abolishes slavery and puts the word into the Constitution. Now, in the act of abolishing it, slavery is directly mentioned for the first time. That's a fundamental change in a society in which there were 4 million slaves on the eve of the Civil War, and where slavery was the most important economic institution in the entire United States, not just the South. So in a sense, what you're talking about here, to use a modern term, is regime change. How do you change a pro-slavery regime, which is what we had up to the Civil War, into an post-slavery or anti-slavery regime? What's going to be the status of the 4 million emancipated slaves? And who will determine that? The 14th and 15th Amendments are attempts to answer those questions. Is this going to be a interracial democracy, or are the black people going to occupy a subordinate status of some kind? And that is fought out in a bitter political struggle of Reconstruction between President Andrew Johnson and the Republican majority in Congress. The 14th Amendment begins to answer those questions. For the first time, it puts a definition of citizenship into the Constitution. Anyone born in the United States is a citizen. That's the way it is all the way up to today. Now, in fact, that's so common to our thinking today, may not realize it, that didn't exist before the Civil War. According to the Dred Scott decision of 1857, no black person could be a citizen. I don't care where they were born. I don't care where their ancestors were. They could have been from families free here for 100 years. Citizenship was for white people only, according to the Supreme Court. The 14th Amendment wipes that away. There's not going to be a racial definition of citizenship. There's not going to be a religious definition of citizenship. There's not going to be a national origin definition of citizenship. Birthright citizenship is a fundamental principle put into the Constitution in these amendments. And then we could go into the 14th Amendment later because it's awfully long and complicated. But the other really important point is it puts into the Constitution the notion of equality, equal protection of the law. The original Constitution said nothing about equality among Americans. How could it when we had all those slaves? But now the principle of equality is written into the Constitution for the first time. And the 14th Amendment makes the Constitution, therefore, a document to which Americans of all kinds can appeal if they feel they're being denied equal protection of the law. And much of the jurisprudence of the 20th and into the 21st century has been revolving around that issue and of equality and how it's defined in our country. And then finally, the 15th Amendment attempts to protect the right to vote of African-American men. Again, this is a fundamental change. On the eve of the Civil War, only 5 states, and all of them in New England with very small black populations, allowed black men to vote. It's as simple as that. And now 15th Amendment is part of this effort to create an interracial democracy. The other point I will emphasize and then stop here is that all these issues are on our agenda right now. Today, you don't have to go back to Reconstruction. Pick up your local newspaper. Who should be a citizen? That's being fought out on our border with Mexico every day. Who should have the right to vote? State legislatures all over the place are trying to limit the right to vote in one way or another. What does equality mean? That's always being fought at. So, in other words, the interpretation and the meaning of the revamped Constitution is still a very important part of our political debate, even as we speak today.
Yes, and I'd like to kind of focus on 14 and 15 because we have watched the 13th Amendment and that kind of stuff. So we kind of know about that, but 14 and 15.
You may not know as much as you think because the 13th, yes, there's been almost no jurisprudence coming out of the 13th Amendment. The courts have generally ruled that its purpose was accomplished when slavery ended, and therefore we don't have to think about the 13th Amendment. However, there is an alternative tradition which was associated with Justice John Marshall Harlan in the late 19th century, and then Thurgood Marshall and others in the 20th, which said, no, it hasn't yet been accomplished. There are the badges of slavery. In other words, what was being abolished? Harlan said, what's being abolished is racism, not just slavery. Racism was essential to American slavery. And the afterlife of slavery in segregation, in, you know, in prejudice and all that, inequalities, should be attacked under the 13th Amendment. The courts have never accepted that except on one or two occasions, but it's still out there as a possible way of maybe dealing with some of the racial inequalities that still exist today. So I just want to say the meaning of the abolition of slavery is more complicated than we sometimes think.
Yes, and I think, too, that's an important point, because I think the thing that people focus on today about the 13th Amendment is the prison.
Right.
Right.
But the criminal exemption that involuntary servitude can still exist for people convicted of crime. And of course, in the late 19th century, that led to a terrible system of convict labor in the southern states, where people, mostly black, were just convicted of minor crimes all the time and then sent away to prison and then to labor camps and all that. And we had our own gulag here, which people don't like to remember, of these labor camps scattered around where prisoners were forced to work with no compensation. So that criminal exemption was a big mistake, you might say, for Congress. So, it would be not, there are efforts even nowadays to amend the Constitution to get rid of that language, but I haven't seen what's happening with that.
And maybe we could talk a little bit about the 14th Amendment and this. Mm-hmm. One of the things that struck me about your explanation of it is this: Congress has the power to outlaw private practice of discrimination, private and kind of legal. So maybe you could kind of unpack that for us a little bit.
Well, yeah, that's what we call the state action doctrine. The language of the 14th Amendment says no state can deny you the equal protection of the law. No state can infringe your liberty, life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Well, what does it mean that no state? I mean, if a state passes a law, that's pretty clear what that is. Or state officials, police, maybe others, acting in a public capacity, that can be attacked under the 14th Amendment. What about a restaurant that won't admit a black patron? Or, other forms of private discrimination. This was debated during Reconstruction a lot. Hotels, theaters would not allow black people as patrons. Transportation, they had to sit in separate cars sometimes, or simply were barred from streetcars in many cities. Well, is that state action? Or does the 14th Amendment allow you to attack private? Now, there's no question that most of the people who voted for the 14th Amendment thought they could attack private discrimination through the 14th Amendment. And indeed, in 1875, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1875, which outlawed, using the 14th Amendment, outlawed discrimination in public accommodations, in places of amusement. In other words, if you open your business to the public, you got to serve everybody. You can't just say no. You know, and again, Harlan said, this is the abolition of slavery, that the making people, declaring people to be unworthy of association with other members of society is a legacy of slavery, and it should not be allowed. But most saw it under the 14th Amendment. But the Supreme Court has never accepted that view. In 1883, they overturned the 1875 Civil Rights Act that I just mentioned. Now, of course, in 1964, a century later, Congress enacted the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which barred this kind of discrimination. So, well, how did they do that when the Supreme Court said the 14th Amendment didn't apply? Well, the court said, well, actually, we're not talking about the 14th Amendment here. We're talking about the Interstate Commerce Clause. Segregation, discrimination interferes with interstate commerce. A black guy is traveling around the South selling, I don't know, vacuum cleaners, let's say. He can't find a place to eat dinner. He can't find a hotel that will put him up. That interferes with commerce. And under the original Constitution, Congress has the power to regulate interstate commerce and states don't. So if states allow this kind of discrimination, they are violating the interstate commerce clause. Now, that enabled the Supreme Court to get around the state action doctrine. But it also, in my opinion, made them look ridiculous because everybody knows that's not why they passed the civil rights. When there were people in the street, you think the people in Birmingham who were fighting against Bull Connor and his hoses and police, they were out there so that people could sell vacuum cleaners more effectively? No, that's not. This kind of exclusion is an insult to a citizen of the country who cannot be treated the same as others. But the court has never wanted to go down that route. Because a lot of them like this state action doctrine for one reason or another. So it's very complicated, the history of these amendments and how the interpretation of them has, in my view, diverged very frequently from what the people who wrote them were trying to accomplish.
Well, and that brings us to the 15th Amendment. Mm-hmm. It seemed to me from the book that it was the most contested, but a lot of people got mad at this one, including the women's right to vote suffragettes.
Yeah. Well, again, the answer that the correct answer to almost any question related to history, I don't care what time period, what country, is it's complicated. That's why I no longer get involved in legal cases. They want me to come and testify. No, you don't want to hear what I have to say. Maybe this or on the other hand. No, lawyers, yes, no. That's not how historians operate it. It's complicated is the historical truth. The 15th Amendment is complicated. Congress had already given the right to vote to African-American men in the South as part of the Reconstruction Plan adopted in 1867. So most black men, and we're talking about men here, women could not vote anywhere in the country, unfortunately, at this moment. Most black men actually were voting, but not in the North. That's the weird thing. Ex-slaves were voting now in the South, and people who had been free before the Civil War in the North still couldn't vote. But more important was that Republicans were nervous about future efforts to limit the right to vote on the basis of race, and they wanted to make that impossible. Unfortunately, the right to control election law, regulations, is something that most states are very anxious to maintain. You know, there were plenty of states that limited, even today, there are 50 different regulations about voting. You can move from Ohio to, let's say Texas, and you could lose your right to vote just because of the differences in the rules about voting. There is no national standard for voting. What there is a series of ways that you cannot limit the right to vote. So, for example, the women's suffrage American, we can no longer have women denied the right to vote because of sex. 15th Amendment says you can't deny anybody the right to vote because of race. Fine. But that leaves intact a lot of other restrictions, which in fact severely limit the right to vote for black people. What about a property test? What about a literacy test? Let's go back to John Marshall Harlan again. He had it all figured out. You deny people the right to learn to read and write because they're slaves. And then you say, well, you can't vote because you are illiterate. Why are they illiterate? This is a legacy of slavery again. They're not illiterate because they're too lazy to go and learn to read and write, because the law punished people who helped black people who were slaves learn to read and write. But the 15th Amendment is, as I say, it's negative. You cannot deny the right to vote to anyone because of race. But there are many other restrictions on the right to vote which do not appear to be violations of the 15th Amendment, although eventually, Congress, in the Voting Rights Act of 1965, gave the federal government the authority to overturn some of these restrictions in the states that were obviously intended to deny Black people the right to vote, even though they didn't say it explicitly. From 1890, when Mississippi adopted a new white supremacist constitution, up until the Voting Rights Act of 1965, Black people lost the right to vote in every Southern state, basically. And when women got the right to vote in the 19th Amendment, it didn't apply to Black women in the Southern states. In the Northern states, it did, of course. And it's very important to remember that Black people in the North could vote, and that once the Great Migration took place to places like Cleveland and other major cities with Blacks, they could vote when they got there, and that began to shift the politics of the Northern states, making Black voters a significant, you know, political presence. But in the South, nothing until 1965. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 is meant to implement the 15th Amendment. It's based on a very clear history of disenfranchisement in the Southern states. Unfortunately, about 10 years ago, it was pretty much eliminated by the Supreme Court in its decision in the Holder case. So right now, states are given basically a free hand to restrict the right to vote as they see fit, as long as they don't directly challenge what's in the Constitution. You can't use race. You can't use sex. You can't say people who are over 18 can't vote. I mean, the age limit there. You can't charge a poll tax, charge people money for trying to go and vote. So that's all now in the Constitution in different amendments. But as we know today, states are being very creative in finding ways that are not explicitly racial, and yet have the effect of wiping large numbers of non-white people off the voting rolls. Now, in the 15th Amendment, there were plenty of people at the time who said this amendment is not good enough. It is not strong enough. It's leaving open ways to the women's rights movement, to begin with, was very angry because it didn't bar restrictions based on sex. It said no male citizen can be denied the right to vote. But states could continue and did continue to deny women citizens the right to vote for quite a while, 50 years, basically, longer. But as I say, one of the reasons for this is even northern states wanted to keep control of the rules about voting. And so by this point, the North was in favor of Black voting and that, but they wanted to be able to, you know, there was a Massachusetts had a literacy test. New Hampshire had some kind of religious test, which was very rarely enforced, but there was a religious test for voting. Rhode Island had a regulation about immigrants having to own property if they were going to vote. It turned out not to be a strong enough amendment because Southern states found ways around it and pretty much eliminated the Black vote for 50, 60, 70 years, starting in 1890 with Mississippi.
Well, and that's so kind of my last question will be, pretty much the story of Reconstruction as we know it is one of failure, and we get to a certain point and then it crests backwards. And how do you feel these amendments fit into that narrative?
Yeah, I've written a lot about Reconstruction in the course of my career. It's quite a few books. I've done a lot of Reconstruction things. I've curated museum exhibitions about Reconstruction. I was the chief historian for a TV documentary series a few years ago on PBS, which was produced by Professor Henry Louis Gates about Reconstruction. I lecture a lot about Reconstruction. Reconstruction is often misunderstood or just not, and people don't know anything about it. It kind of gets overwhelmed by the Civil War. I do try to avoid starting with the question about Reconstruction failing. I have no objection if people want to say Reconstruction failed. Certainly the effort to build an interracial democracy in the southern states on the ashes of slavery did not succeed in the long run. But I think if you start by saying it failed, then the historical question is, well, why did it fail? Fair enough, but you miss a lot of what was going on if you make that your fundamental question. You know, a lot of things that happened in Reconstruction didn't fail. It was a place of tremendous building of institutions, of black colleges, black schools for the first time in most of the country created in Reconstruction. Black churches become the major institutions of black communities in a much bigger way than they had before the war in Reconstruction. Black families disrupted under slavery now consolidate themselves. A whole group of institutions are created. This is really the foundation of the modern African-American community. Reconstruction created the space for that to happen. So that survived. Now, it is, of course, true, as I say, that these amendments pretty soon were basically abrogated in the South, the so-called Jim Crow system. Abolition of slavery, well, yeah, slavery is not restored, but through the convict lease and other systems, unfree labor still persists in the South into the 20th century. Equal protection of the law, that goes by the wayside pretty fast under the Jim Crow system. The rise of lynching, you know, what kind of equal protection of the law is it where mobs can just go and murder people with impunity and the public authorities do nothing or even encourage it in many cases? That is not, but again, there you get your state action problem. The courts say, well, you know, a mob of people murdering someone, yeah, that's terrible, that's bad. But, you know, it's not the state, the government is not doing it. Therefore, under the 14th Amendment, we can't do anything about it. It's up to the states. But the states don't do anything when lynchings take place. So, about a month ago, Congress passed the anti-lynching bill, right, which has been debated for almost a century, that members of Congress have tried to get making lynching a federal crime. Now, thanks goodness, we don't have lynching anymore, really. I mean, it's estimated that from 1880 to 1960, maybe 4,000 people were lynched in the United States. It makes you wonder if we are really a civilized society when you step back and wonder, think about that. But so in other words, there's, and then the 15th Amendment, the Supreme Court allowed states to get around that very, very quickly. As long as a law didn't specifically mention race, but had the effect of eliminating black voters, the Supreme Court let it go. So, you know, there's a lesson here, which is that, as you said, progress can go backward, too. This is what we call, you know, racial backlash, which we've seen in our own time after the civil rights movement. And in the aftermath of Reconstruction, there was a serious and violent backlash against the constitutional amendments and the entire idea of the United States as a multiracial democracy.
Well, I think that's one of the most important things that I think we've talked about in our group is that while the institution of slavery went away, the mindset and the behaviors and some of the white supremacy, as it were, really remained entrenched in the Confederate.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's often said correctly, you can't legislate what people think, right? You can't. On the other hand, you can make it illegal for them to act on what they think if their actions interfere with the rights of others. So, in other words, we shouldn't just throw up our hands and say, well, I don't know, racism is just forever and there's nothing we can do about it. So, no, if there's a federal commitment to enforcing the law, enforcing the Constitution, people can change. I mean, look at the civil rights movement of the 1960s. There have been enormous changes. You know, it's not like we've achieved nirvana, but there's been enormous changes in our social relations with one another across the color line, which were very difficult to imagine back before the civil rights movement. I mean, look at just interracial marriage. I mean, that was considered so weird and off the charts that you're too young to remember this. I remember, not marriage, I remember when Petula Clark, the singer, had her show canceled because she kissed Harry Belafonte on the cheek after they sang something on TV. And this raised such a ruckus that she was thrown off the show. Today, thankfully, that kind of thing is not likely to happen. There's been a lot of change, but on the other hand, as we said, things can go backward also, and we've seen some of that. And in some areas, things never got going in the first place, because one of the problems of Reconstruction was the failure to give the former slaves a kind of economic basis for the freedom they had acquired. With the phrase we all have heard, 40 acres and a mule. Black people coming out of slavery, they said, we need land to be truly free. In an agricultural society like the South, if you have no land, no economic resources, you have no choice but to go back to work for the same people who have enslaved you. And that's not genuine freedom. But even the Republican majority in Congress was not willing to redistribute, to take land from the wealthy plantation owners and redistribute it in 40-acre plots to Black families. So you might almost say the political revolution, partly embodied in these 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, the political revolution went forward. But the economic revolution of the end of slavery was stalled because of the inability or unwillingness to give Blacks economic wherewithal to go with the legal freedom they had acquired.
Yeah, and then the whole Supreme Court thing is one other matter.
Well,
which we're still dealing with, I suppose.
They say the Constitution is what the Supreme Court says it is, right? Weirdly, because the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments all end with a section saying Congress shall have the power to enforce this amendment. They didn't trust the Supreme Court back then. The Supreme Court was the court of the Dred Scott decision. Congress didn't want the Supreme Court telling it what it should and shouldn't do. So they put into these amendments that Congress will enforce it. But the Supreme Court doesn't like that. They want to determine what happened. So when they overturned the Voting Rights Act of 1965, they basically said, I don't care what Congress thinks. We're telling you what can and can't be done vis-a-vis the right to vote. So you had this long period from the 1880s all the way into the mid-20th century of the Supreme Court little by little eviscerating the importance of these amendments. It didn't happen all at once. There was not just one decision. It was a whole series of things. One could give you a long list from Slaughterhouse to civil rights cases, Plessy v. Ferguson. Some of them are well known, some of them are not well known. But over time, all these basic principles were limited or destroyed by a conservative Supreme Court. And it's another example of the fact that our Constitution is not self-enforcing. Somebody has to enforce it. Congress said, we're going to be the ones who enforce it. Supreme Court eventually said, nope, sorry, you can't do that. Here's all the things you can't do. We are telling you how you can enforce it and how you can't enforce it. And that battle is still going on today.
Well, I think we could probably talk about this all day, but this is a great place to leave it. So,
it's a pleasure to talk to you, and I always commend groups of people who want to sit down and read history books and talk about history and debate about history. And one thing I'll say about the Reconstruction era, it is one of the most relevant periods in American history to our own time today. And that's one of the reasons that it's very important for people to know something about Reconstruction and about these amendments and what they, Congress back then was trying to accomplish.
Thanks for listening to Unpacking 1619. For more information on Heights Library 1619 Project Discussion Group, or to check out more interviews with scholars, please visit heightslibrary.org. See you next episode, wherever you listen to podcasts.